On Saturday, more than 2,000 people gathered at the Smith Center in downtown Las Vegas to honor Metro Officer Alan Beck. Beck was one of two officers ambushed and slain a week ago in northeast Las Vegas. Friends and loved ones remembered Alan Beck the man, but Metro Sheriff Doug Gillespie used some of his time to focus on the armed assailants who killed Beck and his fellow officer Igor Soldo while they were eating lunch.
These two criminals took from all of us what they can never have or never come close to being. On that day, they took two honest, hardworking officers from us.
As the community grapples with these shootings, we are wondering, what can be learned from these events, if anything? The assailants were motivated by a hatred of governments, apparently. Is there something to be understood about political extremism, mental illness, perhaps a need for more gun control? And what do these shootings reflect on our community? Joining us in the studio to talk about these issues and more is Pastor Robert Fowler of the Victory Missionary Baptist Church. Pastor Fowler, welcome back to KNPR.
Good morning. Thank you. Good morning. Always good to be here.
What have people in your congregation been saying about these shootings?
Well, you know, we have a plethora of police officers in our congregation, so we have a tremendous love and affection for first responders and military people as well as law officers. And we also have in our church a young lady who was working at CC's when the couple came in and they asked her where the restroom was, and she pointed them in the direction of the restroom, and she said the next thing she heard were the gunshots. And she, you know, kind of ducked, and the manager ducked, and others as well. Fortunately for her, she was not hurt, but unfortunately for her, they were in position to visualize what happened to the police officers.
Did you talk about this in the pulpit yesterday?
We did. We basically offered our prayers to the families and to the community. From the vantage point of a pastor, however, I communicated the necessity and the need, since it was Father's Day, the necessity and the need for us to pass on healthy values to our family and to our children, and to do our best not only to pass them on, but to do whatever we can to ensure that our children are inculcating these values into their hearts and into their lives. I think one of the things that this tragedy and other tragedies continue to point out to us is the need for collaboration and all of the institutions that deal with children and individuals to ensure that we do everything that we can to pass on good values, because obviously we are missing the mark someplace.
Also joining us today is Howard Beckerman. He's program director at Temple Sinai. Howard, welcome back to the program. Your father was a police officer.
23 years in New York City.
23 years. So you've got some real affinity with what happened last week. Does it make it any easier for you to comprehend this tragedy?
It doesn't. I think back to my late mother, and as a child, it didn't hit me as much, but I could see on her face any time that my father went to work and came home late for various reasons, that she was always nervous that something would happen. It's very rough, not just on the police officers, but on their family, on their children. It's something that the community has to coalesce around and be appreciative and help out the policemen on and off the job and their families.
How did you feel when you heard about the shootings two Sundays ago?
It brought back memories. When I was a child, a police shooting was very, very rare. And it made the front page of the newspapers and everything else stopped. And I think that happened here in Las Vegas. We woke up to that as a community and said we have to do something to help out the police, their families, the other policemen around. And hopefully this will be a lesson to the community to give the police officers in their community a lot more cooperation than we have in the past.
Part of the shock with this crime, this ambush shooting, was the senselessness of the motive. Last week we talked with former Sheriff Bill Young, who spoke to that on our program, and this is a little bit of what he said.
I get crimes of opportunity that go bad, robberies that don't happen the way they should have. And I get homicide, crimes of passion, greed, jealousy. I get all that. But I do not get this one at all.
Now, also with us today is Maggie McCletchie. She is an attorney at Langford McCletchie. Maggie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate having you here. You work with clients accused of crimes from time to time, and you heard what Sheriff Bill Young said. Is there a way to explain this crime, or is this one that it's just seemingly hard to get, as he says?
It's very hard to get, and I'm somebody who my firm does do criminal defense. I'm someone who has been critical of Metro practices and has sued the department in the past and has ongoing litigation with the department. But I'll say this: my heart goes out to both officers, the whole department, and also goes out to the third man who is somewhat neglected in some of the news stories, with Mr. Wilcox, who also tried to intervene and tried to stop what was happening.
Hmm. When you're looking at something like this, do you see in this, do you see insanity? Do you see delusions? Do you see a pathology of some sort?
Well, I looked at the Miller's Facebook pages and some of the YouTube videos, and they're extremely disturbing. They don't make a lot of sense. I've read the articles, and I don't think we're getting a really clear picture of what exactly was going on with the Millers. For example, some people have said that they were espousing white supremacist ideology, that they were critical of, that they were anti-government, they were talking about overthrowing the government. But I want to be crystal clear that no matter how awful someone's opinions are, having those opinions in and of itself doesn't necessarily indicate that somebody's going to commit a violent act. But in this case, they were. And one thing that I find disturbing is that there were neighbors that they apparently said some pretty specific things to. So these weren't just people who said, I want the government to be overthrown, or I have problems with police officers. Both of those are perfectly legal and don't warrant any kind of police investigation. But here, we do have neighbors that heard the Millers talking about their guns, knew the Millers had extensive weapons, bullets, lots and lots of ammunition. And we're saying things like, I'm going to kill officers and put swastikas on their bodies. Mm. I'm going to start a revolution. They were saying pretty serious things. Now the neighbors say, well, you know, I didn't really believe what was going on. But I think in a situation like that, if I had a neighbor or roommate, I think one of them was the roommate too, who had a bunch of weapons. Well, first of all, I wouldn't have a roommate that had ammo around the house. But if I had a neighbor that was saying those kinds of things, I would certainly call the police.
Now, also joining us for this conversation from Washington, D.C. is Matt Ford. He grew up in Southern Nevada, but is now working as an associate editor at The Atlantic magazine. He wrote about Nevada's peculiar history of race relations when Clive and Bundy argue that emancipation has made life worse for many African Americans. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Is there something in the history of Nevada and its disdain for the federal government that could encourage the kind of anti-government obsession that seems to have fed the Millers?
Well, it's actually kind of a strange paradox, because in many ways the state was founded, you know, during the Civil War by Abraham Lincoln, a defensive of sort of federal power, if you will. But because it's always been a state on the frontier, there's always been these tendencies to kind of not need government. We have a part-time legislature, as you know. We have, you know, a smaller court system than many other states. It matches the pattern you see in a lot of the western states, where there's, you know, a definite skepticism of the reach of government, but not necessarily, it's never really manifested on a broad scale into actual violence towards government officials. This is something kind of rather unique and hopefully more isolated.
Yeah. Should we be surprised that he showed up with the militiamen and such at the Bundy Ranch?
I don't think we should be. When you look at the kind of rise in this sort of anti-government militia activism, it has been accompanied by an increase in violence towards law enforcement, towards other people. You know, the Anti-Defamation League said that there's been a 50% rise in violence towards law enforcement officials over the past few years by these kind of anti-government activists. Mm-hmm. And while Clive and Bundy may not want to, you know, encourage or support these things, I haven't seen any evidence that he would support these actions. His words definitely strike a chord with people who do see the federal government and perhaps any sort of government as a serious threat to their liberties.
It's a number of people, some of them Nevada natives, have insisted that, pointing out that Jared and Amanda Miller lived in Indiana, were fairly recent rivals in the Southwest. Is that a fair point? Are these kinds of anti-government hatreds more likely to show up in other parts of the country?
I think that is a fair point. And when you see them more in, you know, areas where it's less urban, more rural, you know, places like, you know, areas in Indiana, areas in Texas, Idaho, which has a significant number of militia movement supporters, Montana, These kind of states where you can really get away and sort of form your own community tend to have higher rates of that. That doesn't mean they don't exist in major cities, of course, but there is a clear correlation.
Yeah, but if we're not incubating that kind of hate, what accounts for Nevada's seeming to serve as something of a magnet for people who have these kinds of thoughts as the Millers did?
You know, I that's really the key question here, and I wish I could have an answer for you on it. It's definitely troubling to see in an area that has not really had this in its history. You know, we don't have a history of in the 1990s when there were these standoffs on these with the federal agents. We're talking Ruby Ridge, Waco. We didn't really have that in our state. And so this is, in many ways, something very new for us. But it also has its origins in something that is much more common in our culture, which is, you know, not necessarily a fear of government, but just a, you know, mistrust of it.
Maggie McClatchy, you spoke of the whole kind of the civil libertarian angle on some of the words and the thoughts expressed, and you know, it's not illegal to say these things. It's just acting on them that is where the trouble begins. Is there something in the libertarian tradition of the Southwest that encourages that kind of close to over the top sort of talk?
Absolutely not. And I didn't call Mr. Miller's political positions libertarian. I take that I consider I'm a civil libertarian, and I want to make very clear there's a big difference between right wing white supremacist. People who want to violently overthrow the government and commit violent acts, and people who identify as libertarians. There's also a difference between people who commit terrorist acts, and that's not a word that has really been thrown out about this, but it was a terrorist act, and people who have even extreme points of view. And I think as we look at solutions and how government starts focusing less on external terrorism and Islamic extremism and maybe turning back to domestic terrorism.
Well, and speaking of which, near Bunkerville, there were several hundred people who came down here a couple of months ago. And how is it that we seem to draw these people to this part of the country?
But again, when we say these people, I want to make sure that we're distinguishing between people who may be peacefully protesting and people who even say that they don't recognize the federal government. That's absolutely lawful to say. I don't like the federal government.
Granted,
this is a different thing.
But there were a lot of people who were pointing weapons, you know, with scopes and such at government officials.
Right.
I mean, those were some of the people who
were
coming down.
Right, and I came on this show and talked about some of the issues with the people who and the behavior of the Bundy folks and some of the people that were there, as well as some of the concerns with the BLM free speech zones and the response from the BLM. But my point is that just because somebody shares a political point of view with somebody else doesn't mean that all people with that point of view are necessarily dangerous. And I do think we need to, after 9/11, I think we obsessively focused on our perception that the true danger was from Islamic extremism, which is a danger, but we also have to focus on domestic terrorism. And a word that hasn't been thrown out as domestic about this incident very much is terrorism. And I think it was, although I don't think it was part of an organized attack, I don't think the Millers were part of a broader group because they couldn't. They were kind of working in isolation. They tried to go be part of the Bundy thing. They were following certain politicians around in town, but they didn't seem to be part of an organized group. But this was, in my mind, a terrorist attack. Those two officers were victims of a hate crime. They were killed because they were officers. And 15% of the victims of extreme right-wing violence are police officers.
We are talking about the lessons and significance of the recent killing of two police officers and a civilian 2 Sundays ago. And we'd like to know what your reaction has been over the last 8 days or so. How have you come to terms with the shock of these events? Do you look at them and see a reflection on the Las Vegas community? Were you moved to go to one of the officers' funerals? Did you salute the casket as it moved from the church to the cemetery on Thursday? What was special about this event that affected you? Maybe got you to make that extra effort. We'd like to know what you make of these events and how they will impact all of us in the future. You can join our conversation at 702-258-3552. That's 702-258-3552. You can also tweet us at KNPR News or post your comments at knprnews.org. One of the big questions here has turned out to be how a convicted felon could arm himself. And we don't know the exact answers to that, but it does have people asking questions. And here is Sheriff Bill Young again from our conversation last week.
You know, the gun rights folks, I'm a, you know, first to say that I'm a Second Amendment supporter and believer. It's one of our founding principles. But I also think a little shred of common sense should be inserted at certain places.
So, Matt Ford, do we need some common sense gun control? And if we do, what would that look like?
I mean, that's one of the key issues here. And I personally am very eager to see the reporting on how exactly the Millers acquired these weapons. But it should be noted that there are already procedures in place to prevent them from getting firearms. Jared Miller had multiple convictions, including a few felony convictions. So lawfully, in any jurisdiction, he should not have been able to obtain firearms. Mm-hmm. How he obtained them shows a serious gap in our ability to kind of enforce the laws we already have. And mm-hmm. at the same time, highlights that perhaps more, you know, expansive measures might be needed. That's something that policymakers will have to focus on in the days and months ahead.
And there was some conversation with Bill Young last week about a lot of the gun shows that are here, and the so-called gun show loopholes that yeah. allow people to buy these without background checks and such. Maggie McClatchy, do we need to do something to close these loopholes?
Well, We don't know the specifics mm-hmm. of how exactly they got their guns. And as Matt was talking about, there are existing laws that maybe could have been enforced better. There could have been lags in how existing laws were enforced. For example, as he pointed out, it was not lawful for him to have these guns because of he had a very long criminal history under existing law. So sometimes when you look at something that happens, you talk about what laws need to change, what needs to happen. You also need to think about, well, was there a problem in the enforcement of the existing law. Again, how gun law changes in existing gun laws could have prevented this particular situation, I don't know until we know more specifics about how they obtained their guns. But things like background checks are obviously an important part of the story. I'm somebody who does support the Second Amendment. I do think that the Supreme Court has declared it to be an individual right, but we do need to think about how we balance people's individual rights against public safety.
Howard Beckerman, do you look at this and see maybe a magnet for people who think as the Millers did, whether it's because of the events going on at the Bundy Ranch or elsewhere?
The actions at the Bundy Ranch were probably a magnet for people like the Millers. We all want to uphold free speech, but with free speech comes responsibility. And so the people who were at the forefront of the Bundy controversy, not just the Bundy family, but elected officials, other prominent people, need to learn that what they say may be allowed under free speech, and we would encourage that, but they have the responsibility to temper their words, to understand that there are crazy, insane people out there who are going to take their words, twist them in a way that they may not have intended, and use them as an excuse to start off. I should point out, especially for Maggie, that there was a Supreme Court decision that came down this morning. 5-4 on something along this point. There was a gentleman who bought a firearm legally under his name for somebody else who was legally allowed to have it.
Now, we are going to get into that a little bit later on. We do want to talk about that because that is a decision that's got a lot of bearing on this conversation. So we are going to get to that shortly, Howard. Matt Ford, we've seen dozens of these episodes, some of them from delusional people like the assailant in Newtown or the Denver movie theater the night the new Batman movie opened. There are some more calculated crimes then, like this shooting at the Metro officers here. Is any of this having any impact on the debate about gun control?
I think it's definitely kind of bringing it back to the fore. We've seen kind of we saw in the early 1990s a rise in it. We had the Brady Bill, we had the assault weapons ban, and it really kind of highlighted that the shift in the culture. But as these faded over the past decade, it kind of sank in the background. Now, after Newtown, Aurora, Sandy Hook Elementary, I guess that's the same as Newtown, they have really raised the profile of this. And what it illustrates is that we when we have these individuals who we claim are, you know, mentally disturbed, many of them are, this is not something that's unique to the United States. Mm-hmm. Every industrialized country in the world has people with mental health issues. Every industrialized country in the world has watches American movies. They have access to American video games. And yet they do not have the epidemic of gun violence that we do in this country.
So is any of this metric going to change, Matt Ford? I guess given the presence in this country, too, uniquely, of, say, the National Rifle Association.
You know, the National Rifle Association exerts so much control over the gun control debate. Even after the deaths of 20 children, and in a very public, very shocking fashion, little was able to be done due to their stiff resistance. And if something like that incident won't even persuade Congress, it's really difficult to see a way to kind of break that monopoly. Mm.
The conservative columnist for the Washington Post, Kathleen Parker, pointed out this week that the fate of James Wilcox, who was also murdered during the spree, debunked the usual argument that citizens carrying concealed weapons are the best defense against crazed killers. And she wrote, I'm quoting here, even as we honor Wilcox appropriately, his death should give pause to any who insist that having more armed citizens is the best defense against a would-be killer. Even if one person were to stop a killer in his tracks, it's not logical to extrapolate the occasional success story as proof of the argument. Maggie McClatchy, will James Wilcox's death, doing what the NRA says they should do, diminish the idea that a good guy with a gun is what's needed to stop the bad guy with the gun?
I don't think that this is going to affect the gun debate that much. I really don't. In terms of him being a bystander, because somebody might say under different circumstances, if Amanda was behind him, saw what was going on, and then killed him. So, I don't know that it changes the debate. I don't think people should engage in vigilante justice. I'm not an advocate of that. I think stores can legally keep people out who have guns. I don't think that the Second Amendment means you have a right to have your gun with you at everywhere at any in any fashion at any time. And so the long and short of it is I don't think that this incident is really going to shift the gun debate that much. After Sandy Hook, we still didn't see changes in gun laws.
Hmm. Matt Ford, same question to you. Will this additional death of James Wilcox knock down the idea that to stop a bad guy with a gun, you need good guys with guns?
I can't really see it making much traction on that. Like she said, the unique characteristics of the case, the fact that there were two shooters, which, despite we always think that there might be multiple shooters, it almost never is the case. A male-female couple. This in many ways is a very exceptional shooting profile, and it's hard to extrapolate any broader significance than that because it is such an outlier. I don't see it having much influence beyond, the local debate on the national stage about what we should do next.
Yeah. Matt Ford, I know you've got to go shortly, but I do want to ask one more question. Southern Poverty Law Center reported in the 90s that the threat from militia groups had risen, and we saw the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. For some years now, they've been reporting more activity among white supremacist and anti-government groups. Is this kind of activity inevitable whenever a Democrat is elected to the White House?
Wow, I hope not. There is certainly kind of a correlation there, and there also are other factors at play. After 9/11, we saw definitely an increase in sort of patriotism, of nationalist support for the country, of kind of a greater political unity even among broader disparate groups. That could have had an effect as well. It would be nice if that was not the case, and I hope it is not, but we've only had really two Democratic presidents under which this has had a problem.
What accounts for the rise in these groups?
Well, another factor in that's kind of fueling this time is, in addition, we have an African-American president. So white supremacist groups are already kind of on heightened alert about that. We also have had a severe economic recession, which has left many people without the economic opportunities that they would normally have. Now, granted, we didn't have those during the Bill Clinton administration at the same level, but, I really hope that's not the case, because if it is, we're going to have to seriously reevaluate how we conduct our political culture in this country. If whenever a certain party is in control, we have an increase in violence. That's something that's a serious issue for our democracy.
Matt Ford is an associate editor at The Atlantic magazine. We have a link to his recent article about the standoff at Clive and Bundy's ranch at Bunkerville at knprnews.org. Matt Ford, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
We are talking about the lessons, the significance of the recent murder of two police officers and a civilian two Sundays ago. And we'd like to know what you think. Our guests include Pastor Robert Fowler, Senior Pastor of the Victory Missionary Baptist Church, Howard Beckerman, who is the Program Chair at Temple Sinai, and Maggie McClatchy, an attorney with Langford McClatchy. We'd like to know what you think as well. Call us at 702-258-3552. That's 702-258-3552. You can also write to us at knprnews.org. We'll start with callers with Harley in Las Vegas. Harley, thanks for calling and welcome to the program.
Thank you. I was just calling just to make a comment. My name is Dr. Pearlie Smith, and my area is mental illness, actually. Mm-hmm. And one of the lessons that I believe that not only Las Vegas community, but that all communities have to learn is just the identification process of what's called the four-step process. And with that identification process, we have to recognize and identify some of these signs and symptoms that are displayed by a number of people before these crimes are committed. While looking at the web page, studying a number of things that were going on, there were signs and there were a number of things that could have been reported before this horrific act actually happened.
Now, I understand, Hurley, that you see this as a hate crime. You don't see this as an illustration of mental illness.
I think that it's a correlation between both. I actually see it as both, and especially with my area being bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, I believe that they do go hand in hand sometimes, but I don't just see this as a hate crime. Just because of looking at the videos and reading some of the comments that were made, I definitely see some mental illness that is definitely involved there.
Is involved there as well. Hurley, thank you very much for your call. 702-258-3552. Next is Eric in Henderson. Eric, welcome to the program. Hello, Eric. Are you with us? You're on the air. All right, we will try to get to Eric in just a moment. 702-258-3552 is our number. 702-258-3552. Pastor Robert Fowler, I have no doubt that you have had parishioners wanting to revisit the longstanding question of why this kind of evil exists in the world. You know, why it's allowed by a loving God and such, and I'm sure you have probably discussed that quite a bit. What are you telling your parishioners about that?
When it comes to the issue of the question of evil in the world, that has to do with free will, that, you know, the God that created us didn't make us robots. He gives us free will. But now, along with that comes the balancing act, and that's the responsibility of teaching values, teaching morals, and teaching people how to live in unity and in affection with one another. And I think that where we're missing the boat is in the area of teaching people how to live with one another. I think we're missing it in the home. I think we're missing it in the church. I think we're missing great opportunities in the home. I think we're missing great opportunities in the church. And I think we're also missing great opportunities in the institutions that have the responsibility for helping people to live and be successful in society. And I think the big challenge for us with all of these incidents that are taking place, and I don't think we're embracing it, is the reexamination of how we are teaching people to live in social environment. The church, the home, and the institutions that have that responsibility, which are academic or whatever the case may be, we are not doing a very good job of teaching that.
Do you look at this as an example of evil, evil in the world?
This particular situation?
Yeah, this particular, these crimes.
Absolutely. Hmm.
If it comes from humans, if it's not something that has its roots in a higher power, why does God allow apparently innocent victims to be cut down? These men didn't do anything.
I think free will is the issue there. Mm-hmm. And let me say this, that just because it comes from humans does not mean that it cannot be demonically influenced.
Mm-hmm. Howard Beckerman, you've felt sure that your rabbi would be preaching about this kind of random evil on Friday night. What did he say?
He alluded to the fact that all of us have a responsibility as a collective towards each other, that we have to work as a community, that we have to remember those that sacrificed their lives so that the rest of us could live. At our temple, we say the Kaddish prayer, the prayer for mourners, and we say out loud those that we are saying it for as a community, and the two policemen and Mr. Wilcox were at the top of the list, obviously. I should point out that it's certainly possible that these officers and Mr. Wilcox sacrificed their lives because the two killers had an arsenal where they could have killed hundreds of people and were probably planning on killing hundreds of people. And instead, they were only able to kill three. So while their deaths is a tragedy, it may have alerted in time the police to go and take care of what they had to take care of.
As per Pastor Fowler, do you look at this as a random act of evil?
I believe it's a random act of evil, but there are several random acts of evil. You cannot put all of them in one box and say these are all the same. but there will be random acts of evil everywhere. They will continue to be. Our job as a society is to minimize the possibility of them happening. We can never prevent 100% of the evil from happening. What we can do is attempt to minimize it.
It sounded like your rabbi's message on Friday was something of a variation of what Pastor Fowler was talking about, the idea of free will and that we are a collective. We really look out for one another, ideally. Was that a message of comfort for you?
It was, and it's a message of warning also. As Mr. Ford pointed out, we have a very libertarian streak here in Nevada. We look at the individual as the supreme person, the supreme being in Nevada, that we are out for ourselves, number one. And I think it takes a change in mindset to realize that we are part of a community. We are part of the United States. We are part of Nevada. And we have a constitution that we all need to live by and support each other rather than say, I come first and what I want to do is what's most important.
Do events like this, random acts of evil like this, ever shake your faith in God?
No. No, it doesn't shake my faith.
Why so? Or why not, I guess I should ask.
Because I look at it as going forward. I thank God every day for the blessings that we have. You, as I said, you cannot eliminate evil in the world. What you can do is thank God for all the positives that you have and go forward and look to create more positives in the community.
Pastor Fowler, same question to you. Do you ever find your faith shaken by some of the things you encounter like this?
Excuse me. There are incidents that cause tremendous questions. It doesn't shake my faith in God. There's a difference between permitting something and causing something. And while God may permit it because he gives us a free will, he does not cause it. And so, therefore, my faith in him as a supreme being is not shaken. My faith in him as a loving God is not shaken. My faith in humanity may be shaken quite often because we are the ones that are making the choices to perform those particular acts. We're the ones that are making the choices to succumb to certain things. And then again, on the flip side, if it has to do with mental illness and things of that nature, then, you know, for me, the question becomes, we live in a society, it's not a perfect society, we have to continue to progress to make sure that certain things can be eliminated from our society, such as people that are mentally ill having the capacity to be able to take somebody's life.
In thinking this over, though, surely this set of events evokes, on the part of many of us, deep despair. Mm-hmm. The idea that somebody would simply walk into a pizza place and deliberately just open fire.
For me, it causes the question of regulation. I hear a lot of people talking about how they support the Second Amendment. I support the Second Amendment too, but I also agree with the former sheriff where there has to be an attachment of some common sense to what we believe. And obviously what we have today in terms of laws, whether the issue is them not being applied or the need for the origination of new laws, whatever we have today is not working. And we need to take a look at what we have today. I personally believe that there needs to be a combination of more regulation to what we have today than what we have. And I think that there needs to be some more gun laws, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Howard Beckerman.
The word you used was despair, and I'm hoping that this incident doesn't give people despair. Despair is when you have this incident and you cannot do anything to change things, to move forward. If the community has an opportunity to reexamine how this happened and to say, we would like to prevent this happening again, then you don't have despair. Then you have an opportunity to do better in the world.
Now, Maggie McClatchy, we've sort of gotten into a little bit of theology here, but also from your perspective as a lawyer, you encounter wrongdoing from time to time in your legal practice and with clients and such. Does something like this ever shake your faith in either your faith in God or your faith in humanity?
shake my faith in humanity, sure. I'm not a religious person, but I do share the sentiment that everybody's been expressing. The caller who pointed out the issues on mental illness and my two co-panelists here, that we need to look out for each other. And I want to point out that that's not contradictory to a libertarian state political ethos. Libertarians think that there should be limited government. They don't necessarily think that people should engage in violent overthrow of government, nor do they not think that as individuals we have a responsibility to look out for each other. And one thing that every time something like this happens, Sandy Hook, this incident, every time something like this happens, you hear all of the neighbors, all of the people the people went to school with, the father-in-law, for example, of Jared Miller, you all hear them saying, oh, these people were really disturbed. I knew something bad was going to happen today. Oh, yeah, these people said they were going to kill officers. Well, why didn't these people do something? And I'm not just talking about calling police, which only should happen, obviously, in a circumstance where you think someone's going to commit a crime. You shouldn't call the police just because you don't like the substance of what someone's saying. But we should look out for each other. If you think somebody has a mental illness problem, you should try to intervene in that person's life. You should try to get them help. We should try to engage in each other's lives and try to engage in our communities. And that has nothing to do with whether or not you're a religious person or what your political point of view is about how big or small the government should be. As individuals, we have a responsibility to look out for each other.
Our number is 702-258-3552. 702-258-3552. Marvin joins us from Las Vegas. Marvin, thank you for calling and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Certainly.
I'm a paramedic here in Las Vegas, and thankfully I wasn't working that day of this tragic event. But if I could take a life lesson from everything that has happened, it is our responsibility. It's our responsibility to look out for one another, to notice these individuals who have these ideologies and who advocate violence, and to report them. And although it's not against the law to have these ideas, I think that we owe it to ourselves. And we owe it to our society to report these crimes, to report these individuals before they commit these crimes.
Marvin, you're a first responder. How do you cope with the gut punch that sometimes comes when you encounter the aftermath of acts like this? How do you avoid sinking into despair?
Well, it's extremely difficult. There are some measures in place to kind of assist us first responders and providers in EMS from the depression that follows only after a huge event like this. We debrief each other. There's a process called critical incident stress debriefing where we could just sit there and talk. There's phone numbers that we could call and speak to psychologists to try to get our mind straight. But ultimately, it's just being together, supporting one another, attending, the funeral, showing our support.
All right. Marvin, thank you very much for the call. Really appreciate your reaching out to us. Lisa joins us now from Boulder City. Lisa, thanks for calling and welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. When I'm an educational psychologist, and one facet of the story that I find interesting, because I've been following it very closely about the Millers, is not only that they displayed what sociologists show is a sense of aggrieved entitlement among rampage shooters, along with their political ideology. They very pointedly made a statement by using a Gadsden flag and a comment that this was the start of a revolution. But I agree with former Sheriff Bill Young when he says that the Bundys and the standoff in Bunkerville gave them a platform for this that made them feel legitimate in their so-called revolution. And another facet that I would like focused on more that I think has been underplayed is that the militias in Bunkerville, they felt like they were legitimate state militias. I believe one of the Bundys, I think his name is Ammon Bundy, referred to themselves in an article as a state militia. And there's actually a state law that regulates volunteer militias. It's Nevada Revised Statute 412.126. And I looked it up, and it actually says that the governor is supposed to license volunteer militias.
These militias were not.
And yet they felt like they are. If you speak to people, they think that any of these, the rise of these militias, they feel legitimate without realizing that there's a law that regulates these militias. And I really believe that had the law been followed, that the Millers would have.
Well, do you think that rhetoric it was something the Millers got a hold of?
I absolutely do. I feel like they felt legitimate in their so-called aggrieved entitlement in taking things into their own hands, and I truly believe they were emboldened by their participation out in Bunkerville.
The things that they heard in Bunkerville. Lisa, thank you very much for your call. Our number is 702-258-3552, 702-258-3552. We are talking about the aftermath of the murders of two police officers and a civilian 8 days ago, and this, perhaps some of the lessons and the significance of those crimes. And we're asking, is there significance, or are we in a place where we can't or won't learn any lessons from this crime? Will we take care of each other, as everyone on our panel has discussed over the course of the last few minutes? We'd like to know what you think. 702-258-3552 is our number, 702-258-3552, or write us at knprnews.org. When Sheriff Bill Young was on this program last week, he was obviously very emotional, but he was also quite scathing about the perpetrators of this crime. Here is what he said about the Millers.
These two suspects are such zeros in this world. These are two subhuman beings, in my opinion, that have never accomplished a thing in their lives. I'm sure they've done a lot of drugs. That's probably their biggest accomplishment. They've committed crimes. They've never contributed to society. They live as street urchins. They've taken up with this so-called anti-government right to bear arms, government suppressionist movement that somehow is transcended to Nevada because of this Cliven Bundy clown out here in Bunkerville. And it's that philosophy of hatred for our government and our way of life, just completely, for somebody like me, I do not understand the motives of this crime.
That was Sheriff Bill Young speaking on our program last week. Pastor Robert Fowler, I was kind of shocked by the anger. I mean, that was really a lot of what I heard in listening to Sheriff Young talking at that point. Can people be zeros? Can they be so evil that we totally dismiss them? Can we completely write off these perpetrators?
His evaluation was based, from my interpretation, his evaluation was based upon their contribution to society and their effect upon society. And he basically says that as far as that's concerned, they are a zero. And I think that there's a place for honest, open rhetoric with regard to how we are impacting and influencing society. Now, as it relates to God and the theologian and the value of all people, then obviously I have to see that I say that every person has value because Christ died for them. And so in that, as a pastor, as a preacher, as a theologian, my position would be quite different than that of Sheriff Bill Young, although I appreciate his sentiments and understand it.
Different. How so?
Well, I think everybody has value. I think every individual has value. And it's, you know, coming from Texas, when John F. Kennedy was killed, I think that there was one or two people at the funeral for Lee Harvey Oswald. And my theology would suggest that one of those people probably should have been a preacher. And somebody needed to reach out to his family, and that probably should have been a preacher or a Christian of some sort. Everybody has value. That doesn't mean that everything that they do should be valued by us, and it certainly isn't. And in his evaluation of their activities, in his evaluation of their behavior, I share it with him. In his evaluation of them as a individual or as a person, I don't share that they're zeros. I don't think Jesus died for any zeros.
Hmm. Howard Beckerman, are the Millers zeros, to your way of thinking?
They might be. There are going to be zeros in the world. Hmm. It's the responsibility of those involved in religious institutions, churches, synagogues, mosques, any religious institution, to try and get them off of the bottom and help them out. But it's also society's responsibility to admit that there are people who are evil and who are zeros, and some of them were never going to change. And as a society, we have to find ways to prevent them from doing harm to others. If they wish to do harm to themselves, there's not much we can do about it. But as a society, we have to make it a point to prevent them from doing harm to others.
Now, I want to play a small portion of Robert Soldo's eulogy for his brother last Thursday, and here's some of what he said.
A few days ago, my mom came up to me and said that she hasn't seen me cry since I was a kid. Little did she know that every single time that I did cry, my brother came up behind me, punched me, and said, "Now cry, baby, you have something to cry about."
That was Robert Soldo speaking last Thursday at his brother's funeral, and plenty of other people told similar funny stories about Officer Igor Soldo. Robert Fowler, why do we hear stories like that at funerals? Why is that a good way to eulogize those who've passed?
It brings back memories of the value that the individual had, not only for our life, but for the lives of other individuals. And when we share stories, those stories impact us to the degree that it reminds us that the individual who we are leaving today, or who we are funeralizing today or burying today, that individual had value, and this is an example of some of the value that they had in my life. And it becomes a matter of appreciation for that person.
Maggie McClutchie, you followed the coverage of all of this over the last 8 days or so and saw a lot of these things. What were your feelings about the coverage of the lives and the passing of these two officers?
I felt that the coverage about the officers was good, and they got a lot of deserved attention. And I think one thing I do think was missing is not the coverage of the officers, but coverage about the third person at first.
Yeah,
he kind of was on the sidelines, and I understand that in some ways what happened to the officers was even more horrific because they were killed because they were police officers. They were targeted just sitting there having lunch because of who they are, people who serve our community. So that's extremely horrific.
So
but
what,
the death of the third person, the bystander, they called him, and he was actually trying to intervene, not just a bystander, was also horrific.
So what were your feelings about all of that coverage as it went on
you
this
know,
past week?
I wanted to know more about the third person that was killed by the Millers. I also still feel like one thing we don't see in the coverage and we don't know is really we still don't know a lot about the Millers in a certain way, and we still don't know enough to try to figure out why exactly this happened. And there's been some sort of bizarre suggestions in the media and on social media that this has something to do with the fact that they were street performers on Fremont Street, and that this is a reason we need to crack down on the street performers on Fremont Street. And I think that line that I've seen in social media and other places is just absurd. If these people happen to be of any profession, we wouldn't talk about shutting down their industries, and that's just absurd. These people happen to be street performers. Street performers are not across the board dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Howard Beckerman, what was the conversation like at Temple Sinai after you said that you'd heard your rabbi talking about this on Friday?
Well, some of us focused on Mr. Wilcox, who was the third victim. It goes against the society viewpoint in the movies and television that all the good guys shoot and they hit their target, and all the bad guys shoot and miss their target. In this case, obviously, we know it was the bad guys who shot and killed Mr. Wilcox. It also, as Kathleen Parker in her article in the Washington Post pointed out, that carrying a gun, carrying a concealed weapon, does not make you immune from being murdered. And having more guns in that situation is not going to make society immune to that. Mr. Wilcox is a hero. I believe he's a hero. And he was trained and had a license and a permit to carry a concealed weapon. But what he didn't get was the training that police officers get in looking at a situation. Mr. Wilcox saw the first shooter. He saw the man, and he went to do something about it. And he died tragically for that. But rather than take a few seconds, step back and see were there any others, which police officers get training in many, many times. So just giving more people concealed weapons does not make the situation any better.
In the final minute or so, I figured I'd ask for about 15 seconds from each of you. If one good thing could come of this, and Pastor Robert Fowler, start with you, one good thing could come from this, what would that one good thing be?
I think that we have begun to revisit the conversation about our responsibility to society. And I think that responsibility begins at home, with the teachings that we get at home. And all of us need to redouble our efforts in the home to ensure that we train ourselves and train our children in ways that would make them fit to live in society. I agree with what my comrade said about some zeros. Everybody's not fit to live in society.
Howard Beckerman, 15 seconds for you. If one good thing could come from this, what would you want that to be?
I'd give a challenge to elected officials and the candidates for sheriff, Mr. Lombardo and Mr. Burns, are both very qualified. And what they should do is get together with other sheriffs, police chiefs around the country and say to the NRA and other people who take extreme positions that, yes, we want limited government, but it has to be not as limited as you like. We need to have rules and regulations.
Maggie McClatchy, you get the last 15.
Rather than focus on a legislative response to this, I would like to see us focusing on what we as a community can do in times like this to intervene in each other's lives and, if necessary, report things for police investigation.
Our thanks to our guests, Maggie McClatchy, Howard Beckerman, Pastor Robert Fowler. You can continue this conversation online at knprnews.org, and we hope that you will.